Hello everyone and welcome to the next edition of the VTX podcast. Here at the Veterinary Thought Exchange, we like to start by asking, what are you thinking? And this week we are thinking and chatting with the wonderful Sam Taylor. Sam is a specialist in feline medicine and we chat today about her love for veterinary medicine and a lot of the amazing things that she has done over her career, including actually seeing some real shifts in what we can do to help our patients, particularly with the discovery of drugs that help us to manage FIP, which before was this completely incurable and an awful condition. So just a wonderful chat with Sam today, and it's honestly so heartwarming, I think, to see the love for the work that she does. So we just absolutely loved chatting with her. I'm joined today, as always, with my friend, podcast friend and co-host and producer, Karen. Karen, how are you today?
Well, lots to live up to there on that introduction.
Right, Sam, well, listen, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. It's a real honour, pleasure, privilege. I don't know those. I can't think of any other words. Anyway, we're very happy for you to be here. I wonder if you can just start for the listeners, just giving us a little bit of an idea of you, who you are, and just a little bit about your veterinary background, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure. So my name's Sam. I work in the UK in private referral practice and I'm an internal medicine specialist. But for many years, I've had quite a big interest in feline medicine. So I'm an RCVS feline medic. But I really like both species, I'll be honest. I've got a lot of dogs of my own, but I find something very uniquely interesting about cats. So a lot of my career has been spent studying some of their diseases and working with cats a little bit more closely, particularly through International Cat Care, who you might be familiar with. We recently changed the name, so take this opportunity to mention that. We were called the International Society of Feline Medicine, and we've changed the name now. We are the International Cat Care Veterinary Society, and I have worked with them for many years and continue to do so. So, yeah, I'm very fortunate. I spend some time in clinics. I spend some time writing. I spend lots of time lecturing, and I consider myself very, very fortunate to have quite a diverse career.
And where did you go to vet school, can I ask?
Yeah, it's a few years ago now. I've got to that point where I try and take the year off the biographies. You probably haven't got to that point yet, but when they say like graduated in, I'm like, no, don't include that. But that was the Royal Vet College all those many years ago. But I did my residency training at Bristol at Langford, which is a place with a long history in feline medicine. And yeah, I very much enjoyed my time there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing. I think with feline medicine in the UK, it's quite a special bunch, you know, of people, quite a kind of, I don't know, there's this kind of elite kind of mastermind of the of feline specialists, who a lot of whom have come from kind of Bristol. Obviously there's quite a strong Edinburgh, you know, influence within that sort of too. I'm trying to think of what it's like. Is it like being in some sort of really cool spy group, or what's that film, like part of a sort of secret society? I don't know how many secrets you have, but how much do you think that has, you know, that kind of the feline you know, label, how much has that kind of shaped the career that you've ended up having?
Yeah, I mean, there's a history of feline medicine in the UK, also actually interestingly in Australia, with lots of connections there too. And I used to look up to people like Danielle Gunmore and Sarah Caney as kind of my heroes, and I consider myself very lucky to work with them now. What I think is a bit unique about feline medicine is that we know that cats can be a little bit more challenging sometimes to deal with. They can be a little bit more subtle in their disease presentation things. So I think sometimes as feline medics, people used to call us at Bristol, they used to say we were a bit fluffy. That's what they always used to say, they were the fluffy group. And we were kind of proud of that, because we hoped it meant we really listened to our patients and our owners, and I also find feline medics are, and feline conferences and things are super, super friendly. We hear this all the time about our feline congress that was the ISFM Congress, now the iCat Care Congress. And we just find it really, really friendly. A lot of people know each other in the field, as you say, but also very, very sharing of information and experience. I've never come across anyone in that field who has sort of said, oh, no, I'm not going to tell you about that, or I'm not, you know, that everyone's very, very sharing and very, very friendly. But that's probably true of veterinary medicine. And I guess us feline medics have just got that fluffy bit on top.
So when you first, I mean, I won't ask you what year then from the Royal Vet College,
You
but
can, you can.
well, because I might over exaggerate and make you and age you much more than you need to
Two
be.
thousand, I think I graduated in 2002.
All right.
So.
Okay. Okay. Well, I mean, okay, fair enough. So that was a while ago, but there's no way around it.
Thank you for that.
That's okay. What would you, I mean, you know, as far as, you know, I suppose when we all look back at that sort of that time frame in our lives and our careers, so much changes, doesn't it? I think, you know, going back to that point, you know, in 2002, could you have any idea, or did you have any idea that this is where you would be, or this is where you would end up, or this is what you would be doing at this stage?
I guess I kind of did. I'm one of those people that's always wanted to be a vet. From when I was really young, I wanted to be a vet from when I could talk. And I worked in a kennels from when I was 11. And I worked at a vet's mopping the floors and making tea when I was 12. So I've always been involved in like vets and veterinary clinics and things. So I always knew I was going to be a vet. And then when I went through vet school, my friends will probably tell you that I was a bit of a geek about, you know, some of the topics. I still went to the parties, but I used to revise quite hard for the exams. So I had a good balance between the two. But I did love it. I loved the content. I mean, I particularly loved medicine through vet school. So I always wanted to be a specialist, but I also wanted to spend time in primary care because I think that's so vital to being a decent specialist. So you're a specialist, Scott, I don't know if you agree, but having a knowledge of the challenges of primary care is vital for you to be a decent specialist to me. So I always wanted to spend some time in primary care, but I knew I just was a real geeky medic from early on.
I love that. I love the fact that you're like, I did go to the parties. Don't let anyone tell you any different.
I did, I
But
did.
actually, I was just a massive. But yeah, I think we should embrace that. Like, I think the parties are overrated. And actually, I know that now, Karen. Don't we know that
Yes.
now? So I think so. We've learned that. You know, I think. Well, you know, that's. I think it's really such an a valid point about the primary care thing. And actually, I spent 5, 6 years in primary care practice, working primarily actually at the PDSA and out of hours. And
Yeah.
that was without a doubt the best thing I ever did. And actually, and I've said this many, many times, the PDSA was still my favorite job to date. Like, that was my best job. I think it was probably better because I was 24 and actually everything was better when you were 24, but equally it's still I look upon that job so sort of fondly. And I just, sorry, just when you were saying you were mopping the floors at 12, I've told this story before, but it just always comes into my mind. I also was at a vet practice at 12, and in the East End of Glasgow. And one of my favorite things about that time and a place was the fact that the vet that I worked with used to smoke a cigarette in between every consult, in the consulting room. So she would smoke the cigarette. She would put the cigarette out on the consult table, move the ashtray over, and she would call the next client in. So that, how brilliant is that?
Incredible.
That's Mrs. Blackadder. I mean, she must maybe not be alive now, but that was my seeing practice sort of memory. I think, you know, it's cool in a way actually that you had an idea of kind of where you saw your career going, and wonderful, I suppose, that, you know, here we are now, because it's not an easy road, is it? All that stuff. I mean, just being a vet's not easy, but you know, I think, you know, doing the specialist thing has its own, you know, challenges. I suppose if, you know, you're saying that you kind of thought you would maybe end up in a place a bit like this. I wonder, do you see differences in the profession over that time? You know, so what would you say the changes that you see within the profession we're working in over that kind of period of time? How has that changed, do you think?
Yeah, I think we have an increasing gap sometimes between primary care and specialist practice, which I don't like very much, really. I think that sometimes modern residency training, and you can see if you agree, Scott, but trains people to be an expert in Cushing's or whatever, but find it very hard to adapt when that client has personal circumstances that they can't pay for something or they can't give them medication. Or I think we train sometimes specialists who are such experts in those diseases, but forget that there's a person and a dog or a cat behind that. And I really kind of believe in, which might be an oxymoron, but pragmatic specialist care, in that you might come to my clinic that's got a CT, but that doesn't mean that I have to do a CT. I want to listen to my client and see what their financial background is, what their aims are. You know, doing a whole body CT and a biopsy and everything, if they're not going to pursue any chemotherapy, well, why are we doing that then? And we can get a little bit formulaic that something presents with vomiting and therefore it has this. It presents with a nasal discharge, there it has this. And I'll sometimes say to the, you know, to the resident or something, there's a CT and it looks clearly neoplastic. Well, have we discussed euthanasia? Well, no, we haven't done a biopsy. But if they're not going to go for chemotherapy, why are we doing a biopsy? So I guess I really like, we talk a lot about contextualized care in primary care, but I think we should be doing contextualized care in referral. And what we've really seen over the years is that we end up just with clients who are like mega insured because there's been this big cost difference, you know, in our bills. You've probably seen it working in referral. Those, you used to have a client that was insured to 4,000 and get everything done, sorted, fine. And now you hesitate. And so you end up then with a gap and we're not then seeing patients that, you know, there's a bit in the middle and we could still help those people and we could still help those cases, but we need to just target our investigations and kind of just have that pragmatism. So I'm probably waffling a little bit, but I guess that's the difference I see, in that the bills in referral were less, there was more sort of flexibility, you know, well, that's an interesting case, so we'll do that, you know, and that seems to have sort of gone. And now we end up with these big bills and maybe doing tests that are they absolutely in the client and patient's interest. I mean, I think all of my specialist colleagues absolutely have the heart, you know, their heart is for the animal completely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I just, yeah, sometimes think because we can do stuff doesn't mean, you know, we should do stuff.
We should. No, I couldn't agree more. And I think that I definitely feel the pressure of the increase in cost. And I think for me, that puts on extra pressure because you almost feel that, I don't know, that in some way makes me feel like I have to do an even more perfect job in some ways. Yes. Than I might. Like, it puts more pressure, yeah, I think, on individuals. And this is across the board. I do think it puts on an additional pressure to do just the, make no mistake, you know, there's no room for error because they're paying so much money. And that definitely is a pressure I feel. And I think one of the things, though, I really couldn't agree more with what you said, because one of the things that I often say to the team that I work with now, if I come back through after an hour and they're like, right, so what are we doing? And I'm like, nothing, we're doing nothing. And so, you know, and actually, the value, hopefully, is in that hour that I've spent with them talking about this problem. And that's okay in itself. Like, if they want to come and just chat through something, I'll give them my opinion for what that's worth. Well, it's worth about $313. But anyway, so the, but whatever, you know what I mean? Like, so the, yeah, you know, whatever that is, the consult fee or whatever, then, and I think that's okay. And actually, a lot of people can go away feeling good that they've talked through something, they've been given options, even if they don't sort of pursue something. So there can be value in just having a conversation about what might or might not be available. And I think that's okay too. And we shouldn't feel like that's failure or not good enough. You know, I think that's, there's value in just having a chat too, you know, and so I do think that that's a really, really sort of important thing to, you know, to consider, and we're still adding value in that sort of way. Even a little phone consult, love a phone consult, just give me a call, we'll chat through it. You know what I mean? Like, that's okay too, you know, so yeah. I think there's value in all of those things, you know?
But we're very fortunate because in referral, we have longer consults. And I really admire our primary care colleagues of doing that and learning about a client and learning about a patient in 2015. God forbid, but I know sometimes 10 minutes, you know, and sometimes I'm sure it causes them frustration when they get a letter from you and me and we've sorted it out in what seems like a simple way because we've been, but it's because we've had the time to listen to the client and talk through their concerns and find out different things. But I know that I found 10 minute, 15 minute consults very challenging to do that. But I think that's hopefully people would consider referring just for that, you know, so that we can dissect exactly. It all down and work out, even if it doesn't lead to tons of diagnostic tests.
Yeah, no, exactly. And there's and that's important to remember that, and there can be value in that. But no, you're right. I mean, we've got such a privilege and luxury of having that sort of time. Mm. You know, time is an amazingly helpful thing, isn't it, in that sort of context. So if you were to look back over the time, your time in veterinary practice, and you were just to pick, if you were to pick one sort of standout moment in your career, what would that be? Just the first thing that comes into your mind.
I mean, I suppose it's a bit recent, but I'd have to talk about FIP probably, because you know I can't get through a conversation without talking about FIP. But just because, when, Scott, in our career or our lives, do you go from 100% death to 90% cure? When does that happen? And so I think having worked on FIP when I was at Bristol and essentially euthanized tons of cute kittens, probably a pivotal moment was the first time I gave antiviral drugs to a cat with FIP and looked at it after 24 hours and it was eating and I couldn't hold it because it was so lively when it had been completely flat and, you know, near death the day before. And I always had this sort of very idealistic idea when I was at vet school and before of changing things and trying to help animals. That's all I wanted to do. And when I did that, I thought, I've helped this animal, you know, and that's that old James Herriot, without a shadow of a doubt, we have helped that animal in this situation. And yeah, so that's probably a real, you know, a real highlight of a disease, I suppose. I'm sure you feel it too, because you've got the drugs where you are now. And that's seeing those drugs become legally available around the world. And, you know, going from a position where we now actually kind of hope a cat has FIP rather than some of the other differentials, which is so weird.
Yeah, that's really funny, actually, because I had a person, so I had a client the other day who was disappointed the cat didn't have FIP because he was really obsessed that the cat definitely did it. You know, Karen, FIP is feline infectious personitis, and
thank you.
Karen and I often have these conversations about random things, like who was it last week? Billy Rubin. Who's Billy Rubin? you know, these were cats that literally we couldn't do anything for, and they're usually young, you know, cats, kittens, actually, and usually very cute, sometimes British Shorthairs. Anyway, but and really there was nothing we could do, and very recently new drugs have been introduced. So that's a really good example. I feel it's like the day that Serenia came into our lives, you know, that was a good day.
Yeah, that was a good day. Yeah. But I'll tell you what, if I can just say also, I'll tell you what else was really cool about this was we talked a little bit about sharing information and like how vets are really, really kind of friend. This FIP is a classic example of that. So the Australians had the drugs before us and they could have said, no, we're going to publish and not shared information with us, because you know, you and I know this happens sometimes. They want their name on the paper. And so they're like, I cannot tell you how sharing and throwing information at us, and we've tried this, and we should use this dose, and have this information, have this data. There was no concern about, keeping it to ourselves, publishing from our institution. There was just none of it. It was like, this is amazing. It works. We've learned this. This might help you. And I run the FIP advice email along with Sev Tasker, Emmy Barker, Danielle Gunmore, and your friend Steph Sorrell. And we've had nearly 4,000 emails from around the world, and it's just this sharing of information. It's really inspiring, and I know it's sort of sounds silly, but it went from this thought and this kind of idea that these drugs would work to this massive, like, international. It's like a book. We could write a book on it, like a story of sharing, and the South Africans sending us information, the Japanese sending us information, everywhere. And so it's really, I found it very inspiring from that point of view, because I think that was quite unique in a disease and a treatment that everybody was just for it and wanted to learn and,
And I think I was, I work in Canada, and I was almost quite proud when they've just sort of started using these drugs, and I was like, yeah, no, I know about that. And I have to, and actually I know that some of the people that are involved in, like, knowing, like, loads about that. And then, so there's something, I didn't do it in a smug way. I was doing it in a very sort of sharing way, but it was kind of, I felt very proud that I had some knowledge of kind of the people that were involved and kind of stuff going on. And actually I had a really proud moment talking about Sev Tasker. I had a really proud moment. There was something, a client had asked me specifically a question. We may have talked about this, about mycoplasma. And she'd sent me a paper that Sev had written about this particular thing to do with mycoplasma. And I even said to the owner in an email, yeah, I know her. And I don't know why I was so compelled to do it, but I was like, that's Sev. And actually funny, another internal medicine specialist texted me yesterday a picture of a review article I'd done actually with Danielle Gunmore on triditis, and he was like, God, I love finding papers that friends are on. Isn't that such a lovely, isn't that such a proud moment? And actually that's funny, it made me really think of that. Like, I do think generally, we do just have, that kind of sort of spirit, where actually there's, of course, there's competition and people are competitive and all that kind of stuff, but actually isn't it much nicer just to be really pleased that your friend has done something cool or published something. Like, even that stuff that you've done recently with the feline lower urinary tract stuff, like, I think it's just celebrate it, be proud, be happy, be, I think that's a much better way to be than be competitive or hide data or be secret about stuff or, I think that's
much better. We can always learn. Nobody's in a situation where you can't learn from other people. Someone will have done it differently. Someone will have treated 10 more cases than you, even if you're the top specialist or whatever, you still learn all the time, don't you? So I love it. Again, medicine geeks, we like talking about it. We like talking about this stuff.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, it's cool, isn't it? So what would you, lots of good days and lots of positive things. I think the FIP example is a great one. What would you say has been a more challenging time in your career? What would you say has been some of the more challenging things that you've had to deal with over the years?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes people say to me, you can't feel any imposter syndrome. That's like, of course you won't get imposter syndrome. And I'll tell you that we do, and I do massively, and I sometimes stand up to speak and think, why have they asked me? I'm going to get found out for the fact that I don't know anything actually, and I haven't read that paper, and I, I'm not completely up to date with JVIM and everything else. And so I've sometimes had real challenges with that, wondering why people want me to do anything. Why would they ask me? They could ask Danielle. Why do I even have my name anywhere near her name? She's so much better than me and things like this. So I still get a lot of self-doubt about this stuff and feel like, someone's going to publish something tomorrow showing that I don't know anything at all.
that paper's coming out actually tomorrow.
Sugar. Yeah.
Can you imagine? Let, no, yeah, that's been published tomorrow. I'm sorry about that.
Oh no, I knew it.
I knew it was coming. It was coming. Yeah.
I've never heard imposter syndrome put that way.
So I still sometimes have real wobbles with that, and I think and probably why I couldn't cope with working in primary care is that I find it really difficult when things don't get better. Still, does that sound silly? With my experience, I still find it really hard and really personal, and really I'm not very good at complaints, and I'm not very good when things go downhill when I feel they shouldn't. And I don't know if I've developed too much of a thick skin with that in some ways. And I found in primary care, you know, a day when you do 10 euthanasias was absolutely intolerable. And so even more admiration for people who work in that situation. And I think that's why I probably don't work full time in clinical practice, because I do find I get over-involved and I get too emotional, and it drains the life out of me, kind of, you know, when you have that client and they tell you how much they love their dog, and that they, you know, it was their partner's dog and their partner died, or, oh, I had this awful one with a child with had cancer and died, and it was their dog, you know, and that, I know those things that we all face. I'm not unique in that. We all face it, don't we? But I used to just, it really still gets to me. And so I love working 2 or 3 days a week in clinic, you know, where I feel I can, you know, see those patients and focus really, really well on them. But I think it's a really, really difficult job, in that way of the kind of emotions. Animals just represent so much, don't they? They're not just a dog. It's not just a cat. It's that person's story. I had a cat for 18 years, and that meant I had her before I had children, before I got married. Like, she was just in our history, kind of thing. And so they're not just cat. Well, you know this. Everyone listening knows this. They're not just cats and dogs. But so I love that, but I also find it quite challenging. And so, yeah, I suppose I've had challenges in that way. And the specialist training is hard too, isn't it? You know, that's a hard thing. Yeah.
Oh my God. We're just in the lead up as we're recording to the exam. I'm heading over to, I'm in on the exam committee now, and I'm so, you know, so glad to be on that side of the process. Just the worst thing is the worst. The specialist training is the worst. I mean, I had some fun during my residency and all that stuff, but actually, you know, it wasn't always great, that process, you know. And actually, I woke up this morning, I was thinking I could be waking up in the midst of study hell, and it brought back a lot of awful memories. So yeah, no, that's a tough thing to go through, isn't it? I think, yeah. You know, you were saying about working, I only work 3 clinical days a week, and that is absolute. But it's taken me a long time to learn all these things, yeah, you know, yeah. You know, to learn how much I can and actually sort of cope with. And, you know, that has taken me, I feel like, longer than it should have done to kind of work out what suits. But I always say to people, you know, people need to be really empowered to just make sure their careers and their jobs suit them, you know, make sure that you're creating a working, you know, timetable or framework or whatever that just suits you. And if that's only 1 day a week, then it's 1 day a week. If it's 2 days, you know, whatever, like, it just, everyone's different. And I think we need to be empowered to find the working pattern that works for us, you know, for sure. Mm-hmm. You've spoken, I think, about, you know, quite a lot of people along the way, you know, particularly people like Danielle Gamour, who are extremely inspiring. I think Danielle's just so inspiring because she lives and breathes it in a way that I think, I don't know anyone, you know, that she's so the feline medicine specialist, you know, but she walks about like she's, you know, Gandalf, you know, she's like sort of... But do you know what I mean?
Again, she just love cats. She's not trying to be famous or trying to be anything. She just really, really loves cats.
I love it. You know, and it just, it oozes out of every part of her, and I love it, you know, and and it's just, but she's also glamorous and cool.
Yeah, she is. Yeah, she's a bit of an idol, isn't she, in that way? So,
you know, so she's just cool. Anyway, so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about who inspires you.
Yeah, I mean, I had lots of people, as you say, in my career, and you might have heard of Tim Griffith-Jones, Professor Tim Griffith-Jones. So he was, anyone who's not familiar, is a professor of feline medicine at Bristol for many, many years. And he used to take residents under his wing and used to share your office with him in first year. And he was this super genius professor, but you have never seen an office quite like it. So you used to come in and you couldn't see him if he sat at his desk because the papers were piled so high all around him and like falling off the shelves and things. But you used to ask him for the, you know, one article from 1999 in whatever journal, and he'd find it for you in amongst all that. Later, he used to get sort of bullied by the fire marshals because it was a kind of fire hazard in his office. You'd have never got him out. But he was really, really inspirational because he was so knowledgeable, but again, really, really cared about his patients and very pragmatic as well. Andrea Harvey was my residency supervisor. So she's another feline medic. And I was so fortunate because last week I was with her in Australia. So she is a specialist in feline medicine who moved to Australia, and she's become now an absolute expert in welfare. And she's really inspiring because she brings what she knows about welfare, particularly in horses and like wild species, into pet animals. And there's a lot we can do in that. As far as kind of monitoring how we look after pets in modern times and chronic disease management and things. So she's been a real inspiration, also from someone so brave to move from Bristol to the outback of Australia and change her life in that way. So I do find people like that really, really inspiring as well. Diverse careers, I think, are fantastic when people have done different things. And yeah, Richard Malik, I suppose, is another one. He's a professor in Australia, if people haven't heard of, and he's published hundreds of papers, but is another person who will help anyone, anytime with a case. He must answer 200 emails a day helping people with cases. Doesn't have to, doesn't get paid. This is just because he wants to help people. And I just find that really, really inspiring.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're also very helpful. Like, I actually, that's really, just to put that back on you, I think I see you pop up on, you know, different forums online and different things. And you're always very willing to help, and I think that's lovely. And I think to myself, God, I should, well, maybe people don't care so much about what I say, but I wish I was helpful like you. You're very helpful and good. So
but there's just no time, there's not enough time, is there, to answer everything and help everything. And I that's the only thing.
What do you think, actually? That's funny, just on that topic of kind of, because you do pop up on kind of some of these Facebook groups and different things. How do you feel about social media? Do you think social media is a good thing in the profession? I mean, that will be something that you definitely seen as a change, you know, because, you know, we use social media now in the profession when we just didn't before, you know. Do you think it's a positive thing, what you see online and the discussions you see and how that's used?
I mean, I think it's a positive and a negative, isn't it? I wouldn't want to be one of our younger colleagues today with the client kind of contacts in social media. And having said that, I'm a little bit unresilient to complaints and things. I would find it hard if someone, you know, posted something like some of our colleagues in primary care have to deal with, you know, on social media. I think that's can be so upsetting. But equally, I love, again, the sharing of information and the talking. One thing that worries me a little bit sometimes, I don't know if it worries you on the Facebook pages and things, is that there's a lot of people who are very, very willing to give advice, and that's really great. But you can end up with people getting lots of different advice that might not always be correct. And I always think, I sometimes read them, I think, oh, I need to stay out of it, but I'm not quite sure that's the right thing. And so it sort of opened up a lot more questions in that way. I don't know what you think, Scott.
No, I mean, I try, and the thing is, I suppose that's the thing. I think there's a lot of, for me, there's a lot of responses that are very confident often.
Yeah. And, yes.
And actually, I would be the opposite. I would be very less likely to jump in with something without having a minute to think about it first, because I would be so worried that maybe I was misinforming or not giving people the right information. So yeah, you can sometimes be kind of a bit taken aback, I think, by people's confidence. But I think that goes with all of these forums, where whether it's clinical or not, the loudest voice is often, you know, are those ones that are going to be heard. And there's lots of opinions, clinical and otherwise, that I don't definitely always agree with. I'm probably more inclined just not to get involved, though. I don't particularly like conflict or being, and I'm so, I do, same. It's funny, because, you know, I someone like, you know, Kat the vet, who we've interviewed before, Karen, where she's sticks her head.
I admire her.
I admire
her resilience.
And,
yeah,
and you know, she's so resilient from that perspective. Like, she just, so regardless of whether you agree with what she's saying, and she would be very, like, if she was here now, she would want to have the discussion. I mean, she's very much like that. But I'm like, oh God, golly gosh.
Don't, you know, no, why are they going to be mean to me? Kind of.
You know, like, even, you know, that's exactly it. Like, I was, you know, Casey McCallum, actually, who, a specialist from Cambridge, who actually I'm examining next week. She'd put a comment on about something recently, and then someone had sort of said, well, what, you know, is that right? You know, and then I could see her going, well, no, just in this context and blah, blah, blah. And like, really, you know, having to sort of really explain herself. And I was like, God, I would be dying if someone was, you know, like, you know, sort of. So I do think it's really kind of fraught with, good and bad, for sure. Even, you know, within I'm sure all communities online, kind of, you know, good and bad.
But again, with the veterinary community, we talk about the veterinary community before being, you know, such a unique. I do think it's very inspiring. If you, I think you and I could probably post on some of these pages asking for help personally or with something else, and you would get 200 people offering to come and probably pick you up from somewhere, or do you know what I mean? I think that is something that is very, and obviously our profession has a lot of challenges with mental health and things, and to see the support that comes behind you know, people in with who are having difficulties, I think that's like the really good side of social media in that way. And that we were always a community, vets, but now on those social, and I'm on Vet Mums, you're on, I think you might be on Vet Mums as well, which is a really, you know, I honestly think you and I could post something and say I'm stranded in Edinburgh, and you'd get X amount of people offering to come and help you or lend you a fiver or something. I do think that in that way, the veterinary kind of community is really, really great in these particularly closed groups. But I think the public interaction is the scary bit for me.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely, I might just do that if I, you know, it's just a good way of getting a lift somewhere. You know what I mean?
I think you would save on Uber, to be honest.
Why are we spending all this money on public transport when we could just be asking vet mums who would actually just come and pick you up? Like,
they really would.
They really would. I'm just going to put that into the universe. if you were to look back on your career and go back to that moment that you were making that ill-informed decision to go to the RVC and not to Edinburgh,
I didn't get into Edinburgh.
Oh, that's awkward. So it was funny because we were talking to Jasmine Paris last time, and I think she got into Liverpool but didn't get into Edinburgh, and that somehow made me feel better. I was like, she can't, well, she's not good at everything, is she?
No, I didn't get in.
Anyway, I only got into Edinburgh, so that was really my only choice.
I think I only got into RVC, actually.
Well, there you go. Yeah, so that was kind of our limiting factor. What would you still make that application? Would you still fill out that form, do you think, or would you do something else?
No, I think I'm really, really lucky. I love being a vet. I love being a vet. Probably too much. I don't know what I'd be without it in some way, you know, in some ways. And I think you have to take control of your own destiny a little bit. I do see people very unhappy in the profession, and I get it. And I think people get trapped. Of course, they're in a location they can't move, so they can't leave that job or their children at school. I get that. And so don't think I'm dismissing that. But I think you have got to drive your own, your where you want to be. And as you and I know, it's to get to be a specialist in things was really hard. And when my friends were all earning triple the money I was earning, and I was working nights as a resident and intern, I did think, why the hell am I doing this? I could go and earn X amount in primary care. But now I'm really glad I did it, because I did essentially buy myself some flexibility. I'm talking to you today, and I'm going to be writing an article later, and I'm trying to write a talk at the moment. I've got where, that kind of where we've ended up has been really worth it. So I'm very fortunate, but I just love it. I love going into a vet clinic and how it smells, and that sounds stupid. It's spoke, but I feel at home in that environment. And all I ever wanted to do was help animals, and I hope I can do that a bit. And so when,
Oh, you
like,
do,
one of
yeah.
our guidelines gets downloaded, and I think, well, maybe that one vet will read that dosage of that, and analgesic, and it will help, So I know it sounds all horribly idealistic and things, but I just think I'm so lucky. And I walk into that vet clinic, I love the way it smells, I love all the people, I love all the camaraderie, and then I just like stroking dogs and cats, or as my husband said, spend the whole day just talking to puppies and kittens.
That's what
So
we do. That's what we
yeah.
do. Well, listen, you're able, we're here we are recording this podcast. You are sporting the most incredible pink shirt with cats on it. I mean, like, if you want to, let's just like really play into the incredible feline specialist stereotype. I don't know quite know what that is, but that definitely fits it. I just love that so
It's
much. So
brilliant.
there's so much There's it's absolutely brilliant. But what I really think is important to focus on in that is you know these different guidelines that you've been part of creating, cultivating, writing, particularly the ones that recently with feeling urinary tract disease, I you have you will really never fully understand the impact that that has on the way that animals are treated. Like, that is so impactful. Like, let's not talk about that obscure paper looking at IL-6 and some random thing, but let's look at these carefully crafted, wonderfully put together, visually pleasing. I think let's give International Cat Care the credit they deserve for making things look nice. Like,
They
that is
are
so important.
amazing.
That's important to me. That makes a difference to me. If an article looks as attractive as the articles that you produce look, that's also a good thing. So I think there's so
People
much
think I'm
about it.
silly with my pictures, but it's got to have a picture. You can't have a page of
No.
text without a picture.
No, it's so I think there's so much about it, and I think you'll never fully appreciate just the massive impact that that will have on lots of cats. So that's an incredible, that's an incredible thing. So if you were to give your younger self or the younger people listening a piece of advice, what would that advice be?
In general, kind of in the
What?
yeah.
To interpret that as you like, yeah.
I got asked this recently, actually. It was BSAVA were asking for some kind of quotes of what you would tell, what you would tell kind of young vets and things like that, and take home messages. And I really, really kind of thought about it, and it was coming back a little bit to what we said earlier. And I think I would say that, not everything does get better, but that's okay. It's not your fault. So something like that, about how it's kind of it's and it's a little bit about failure as well, isn't it? That it's okay to fail and things, but it's okay. You can't make everything better, and that's okay. That's
And
still all right.
that's very powerful, and I think we forget that. And I honestly think that's extremely, extremely important to remember. Although as difficult as that is to kind of digest, I think it's so important to remember. So just to finish up then, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Life goal, adulting goals. I was saying this yesterday because I managed to MOT my car and I felt quite grown up because I'm quite bad at adulting jobs.
That's a great thing.
And I was at a meeting at International Cat Care and one of my colleagues, Sarah Ellis, she's a behaviorist and she always brings her lunch like homemade in all different boxes. Mm-hmm. And that really impresses me. That's such adulting. Yeah. That. So can I say when I grow up, I want to be able to remember to bring my lunch in a plastic box.
But you can. Well, listen, I phone Karen, most days of the week, but when I phone her on a Sunday or Monday, I forget, and she's doing meal prep for the week, and I'm
that's a life goal that I will never achieve.
It's only just been the last literally 2 years that I've been doing that. Not even, I don't think. But I tell you what, it's life-changing, and I'm really smug about that.
I think you should be. I admire it.
You should be.
It's great. Yeah.
But from a veterinary point of view, I've started doing a PhD at Surrey.
Have you?
Yeah. So that I'm really excited about because.
Oh, good for you.
I did actually start doing a PhD years and years ago, and I'm not very good at. Like being in a lab and stuff, I realised. That kind of research is not, I'm just not very good at it at all. I really like, I like kind of what I call kind of dirty data from primary care, we could talk about the conflict between, publication versus real life kind of things. But I like real life data that changes stuff and challenges stuff that people do. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really excited to do a bit more work like on kind of FIP stuff and other things that's from practice and like really practical. And so my PhD will be all about that kind of aspect of healthcare.
That is so cool.
And kind of this big link we talk about at International Cat Care a lot, and that's that welfare is both mental and physical health. It's not just physical health. Us as vets, we are responsible for welfare, and part of welfare is kind of mental health of our patients as well. So that's something I'm hopefully going to be working on.
Amazing.
Oh, you've just gone up in my estimations, if that was even possible, even further. That's so cool that you're doing that. I'm so impressed. Well, listen, what an absolute joy to chat to you today. I just think you're quite cool, and so
not as cool as Danielle, but maybe getting somewhere towards. I'm getting as eccentric with my clothes and the cat themes. And
I'm going to make a terrible reference now. So what was someone saying to me the other day? My friend Warren was saying, Lady Gaga is like Madonna was for us, like for the millennials, so you're just like the
oh, I'm
you're the millennial version
of Danielle. Well, I will take that in buckets. Nice. I will take that. Yeah, I'm fine with that. I'm fine.
So you're the Lady Gaga and she's the Madonna. I think that's okay. I would take that.
I am absolutely taking that. Yeah. Yeah, I'm getting more eccentric as I get older, so I'm happy with it.
I love that. Well, listen, thanks so much, honestly, for chatting. It's been an absolute pleasure. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So a massive thank you again to Sam for joining us and chatting today. Just a wonderful conversation. Massive thank you to Karen for all of the work that she does. A massive thank you to you as our listeners for, just sticking with us and tuning in. And we really, really, just really appreciate that. Do remember to check out VTX and what we do by heading over to www.vtx-cpd.com. Lots of great CPD over there. Do get involved. And we will be joined again with Sam's coming back, and she's going to be with us in our new clinical podcast, which should be out very soon. And we're going to be talking a little bit about feline lower urinary tract diseases. So do join us for that.